firstly, mum, 37, prior to arrival, she'd had an episode of malaria, but she was otherwise well. And as part of our screening, of which I'll say a little bit about in a few minutes' time as well, we do quite an extensive screening process when people have arrived here to make sure they're not carrying other diseases, or if they are carrying other diseases, just the extent of the disease and whether we need to do anything about it. So the blood tests that she had done included a rapid test for falciparum and Vivax that was negative. She also had serology for schistosomiasis. It was negative. She had a blood count that was normal, and she had evidence serologically of past contact with hepatitis B, so that didn't need to be addressed. So essentially, she was pretty well, and as part of our screening, we do an HIV test on everybody, even though they've had HIV tests in the country of origin prior to immigrating, but her HIV test was negative. So the only treatment that she really required was to be vaccinated, and most of these people haven't really had any vaccinations prior to immigration. Secondly, the next page now is the son, age 18, and this little guy, he'd had an upper respiratory tract infection while he was on the plane traveling. He'd been otherwise well. However, when we did some blood tests on him, we found that he had his rapid test for falciparum was positive. Now, the upper respiratory tract infection that he had on the plane might very well have been not an upper respiratory infection, might very well have been symptoms of malaria. It's reasonably common for people with malaria to have symptoms of bronchitis, and although he didn't describe bronchitis, he would have had a fever with his upper respiratory infection, so maybe this was just falciparum that he was describing on the plane. He also had schistosomiasis, IgG, which is the antibody, long-term antibody, it was positive. So that demonstrates that he has past contact with schistosomiasis, but it doesn't differentiate between past disease or current disease. He had a blood count that was normal. If he had active schistosomiasis, you'd expect him to have a raised eosinophilia, a raised eosinophil count, but not always. Like, you know, lots of people have eosinophil counts that are either normal or near normal, or are in the are just mildly abnormal but fluctuate. But anyway, his blood count was normal. He also serologically had past contact with hepatitis B, and he was HIV negative. So next slide. The treatment that was given to KG was standard treatment for malaria, which is artemether and lumefantrine. It's a combination drug now, and it was given. He was given the standard dose of treatment for 3 days. He also was vaccinated, and he also received praziquantel because of his schistosomiasis, IgG being positive, and we couldn't know for certain that he'd been treated for schistosomiasis previously. Next slide. The third person is RG, who was the second youngest son, age 16. Now, this young man had multiple attacks of malaria, and his last attack had been in March of the year that they immigrated. He was getting a couple of episodes of malaria a year. However, he was now well. When he was examined, we found that he had an enlarged spleen, and that's significant too. That could suggest that he either has chronic malaria, or that could be a result of schistosomiasis, or it could be a consequence of another infectious disease. His blood count wasn't normal. He had a raised lymphocyte count and a raised eosinophil count. So the eosinophil count being elevated suggests that he had an active Helminth infection or even active schistosomiasis. He also had abnormal liver function tests, and he had the rapid screening test for falciparum and Vivax, which was negative. But his serology for hepatitis B was positive, and he was determined to be a carrier of hepatitis B. And significantly, he had an E antigen that was positive, and that puts people into a higher replicative group, and they're more highly infectious if they're E antigen positive. So though the hepatitis B carrier state would explain his liver function tests being abnormal. He also had IgG for schistosomiasis that was positive. And to investigate him further, we look for evidence of eggs in the stool and the urine. And we do that because if somebody has active disease, it helps us then to know what sort of organism it is and even what to treat them with, and also what further investigations need to be done in order to ensure that they don't develop chronic disease or don't have chronic disease. So, but unfortunately, the ova that we examined in his urine and stool were negative. He likewise was HIV negative. RG, next slide. RG went on to have standard therapy for malaria. He also received praziquantel, and I've gone on to investigate his hepatitis B status, but I won't talk about that today. And he had catch-up vaccinations. Next slide is PG. So this is the only daughter, age 8. Now, PG had malaria recently, and apart from some dental malocclusion, she was otherwise well. However, despite being well, the rapid screening test for falciparum was positive. And that's reasonably common in our experiences. Falciparum, to somebody who's never been exposed to falciparum before, is an illness that makes you very sick very quickly. But a lot of these people have partial immunity, so they feel reasonably well, but at some point they come unstuck. However, she felt reasonably well. She also had schistosomiasis serology that was positive. She had a normal blood count, which is a little surprising given that she had falciparum in her bloodstream, because you'd expect some abnormalities in the white cell count and even the platelets being low. She had evidence of past contact with hepatitis B and was now clear of that, thankfully. And she too was HIV negative. So this young girl, next slide, this young girl received Reumet treatment for the malaria. She too received treatment for schistosomiasis with praziquantel, and she was referred to a dentist for the malocclusion that she had. So next slide. And the fourth child, it's the son, age 4. Now, this young guy likewise had previous malaria. He was likewise well. However, you know, once again, his rapid test for falciparum was positive. So just like his older sibling, he was positive as well. However, his schistosomiasis serology was negative. He surprisingly had a normal blood count, but he had abnormal liver function tests, and we also found that he was chronically infected with hepatitis B. So once again, this guy was E antigen positive, which puts him into a worse prognostic group for hepatitis B. Thankfully, he too was HIV negative. So next slide. This 4-year-old boy was treated with standard antimalarial therapy like his SIBS. He received catch-up vaccinations, and I've gone on to investigate hepatitis B. So because these tests, the malaria tests came back as positive, this was a little surprising to us. So we then contacted, there's an organisation called the International Organisation of Migration, and this is on the next slide. Now, this organisation is responsible for processing and organising the transfer of refugees and their relocation in the country of destination. So we contacted the IMO to see whether, to ensure that all of the family who were positive for malaria had actually been negative, because one of the tests that get done prior to people being sent from the country of origin is a malaria screen. And all of the tests that were done were negative for malaria, which surprised us a little. Excuse me. So next slide. So in summary, this family of 5 who doesn't have a head, a male head of household anymore, who were all screened prior to departure and were determined to be malaria negative prior to departure, but three were positive for falciparum malaria on arrival in Australia. And four people were treated in the family with Reumet, which is a standard therapy. We chose to treat four people because we were worried that maybe the fourth person, maybe the fourth child, might have been harbouring malaria like his sibs that we just hadn't been able to detect on the rapid antigen test. three of the family were positive for schistosomiasis, and they were treated with praziquantel in standard doses. So that's an overview of what it's like for a family. This is a fairly common story of having a family with significant disease that they've acquired in the country of origin that they've then imported into the country that they're about to resettle in. And it poses some difficulties in their management. And I just wanted to say a bit about refugees now, because I've mentioned that these folk are refugees. First of all, the overarching organisation that has concern for the refugees is the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And, there are about 120 countries that are now signatory to the High Commission for Refugees. And refugees, thankfully, are protected by humanitarian law, which is different from internally displaced people who are not protected by international law. There's the humanitarian law that protects refugees has a principle called non-refoulement, and that's spelt R-E-F-O-U-L-E-M-E-N-T. And non-refoulement, the principle of that, essentially means that if the signatory country to the UNHCR has got refugees in it, then they're not allowed to deport people back to the country of origin. That's what non-refoulement means. So that actually protects, from a legal point of view, that actually protects refugees. Now, this is quite different from internally displaced people, who are people who, for many reasons, in particular civil war, have moved from their village or their home to another part of their own country. They're not protected, unfortunately, they're not protected by humanitarian law because they're still within the borders of their own country and therefore fall under the law of their own country. So therefore it's their own government that should be taking responsibility for them. And we all know that doesn't happen, but that's just how things are organised at the moment. So worldwide, there are about 20 million people on the planet. That's all of the people in Australia worldwide are what are regarded as people of concern. And the High Commission for Refugees regards people of concern as being refugees, internally displaced people, and asylum seekers. And there are some other categories of people too. So the definition of a refugee is somebody who lives beyond the borders of their own country, but for many reasons can't return due to a well-founded fear of persecution. And the persecution can be on many different grounds. It can be due to race, religion, because of their nationality, because of their culture, because of their political viewpoint. So that's essentially a definition of what a refugee is. When people come to Australia, there are a number of different visa categories. So next slide now. There are a number of different visa categories. This is not included on the slide, by the way. There is what's called a 200, a 202, and a 204 visa. Now, people who come to Australia on a 200 or a 204 visa, they're actually supported by the government. So they can get Medicare, for instance, and they can turn up to a public hospital and receive treatment free of charge. However, there is another visa type where people come to Australia and are then sponsored and supported privately. So they cannot have treatment through a public hospital system for free, and that's because somebody's already put their hand up and agreed to look after them financially. But anyway, the United States is the country that receives the most number of refugee settlements. This is old data now, like it's a couple of years old, but the figures won't be significantly different. So the United States heads the list, followed by Australia. Last year, Australia accepted about 13,000 refugees altogether. Canada is next, and you see New Zealand falls further on down the page. So that's just to give you some feel for how many people are relocated to other countries. And just keep in mind that there are about 20 million people on the planet who are people of concern, and it's about 12 or 13 million people on the planet who are actually refugees at the moment. So it's a lot of people that are outside of their own country, and not by choice usually. So, next slide. We have pre-departure health screening protocols for people that are arriving from Africa, and this is particularly applicable to the family I've just talked about. Next slide. The current locations where screening occurs in Africa are five main cities, and three of these cities are in West Africa. And if you flick back quickly to the original map that I showed you, there's Conakry that features, Conakry in Guinea, which is where this family would have exited. Then in Ghana, the capital is Accra, and then in Sierra Leone, which is just next to Guinea, there's Freetown. Freetown's not marked on the map, except Freetown's right on the coast. And then there are two main cities in East Africa, being Nairobi and Addis Ababa. Next slide. So there are a couple of steps that get taken to screen people for disease prior to them emigrating. In the 3 to 12 months prior to departure, there is some medical screening that includes an HIV test and screening for tuberculosis. Next slide. Step two, which happens within 1 week of departure, the pre-departure screening happens as close as possible to the point of departure to ensure that people aren't sick prior to getting onto the plane. And they're basically screened for infectious illnesses, and they're asked about fever, they're asked about fever, respiratory symptoms and gastrointestinal symptoms. And if there's concern that people have any of these symptoms and have active infection, then they're not allowed to hop on the plane until they've been screened and or treated. Next slide. So people receive, prior to departure, they receive treatment for any illness that they might have, plus they're given measles, mumps and rubella vaccination, and they're also given routinely a single dose of albendazole, and that's given empirically to treat for the possibility of a Helminth infection, because Helminth infections are so common in the developing world. If people are deemed to be unfit to fly, they'll get treatment for whatever problem they've got, and then they'll be rescreened prior to hopping onto the plane. So next slide. The documentation that's involved is what's called a health manifest. And refugees who come to Australia and go elsewhere will come with a hard copy of documents of tests that they've had done prior to departure to prove that they've been screened. This information is forwarded electronically to DEMA, which stands for the Department of Immigration and Multicultural Affairs. It now has a different name, but it's based in Canberra, which is our capital. It also documents that vaccinations have been received, and it will document any significant medical conditions. So that gets sent electronically to Canberra. Canberra then forward it to the refugee organisation that is going to be dealing with people in the city that they move to. in this case, it gets forwarded to the New South Wales Refugee Service in Sydney, who then forwards it to one of my team members in Newcastle if people are going to be relocated in Newcastle. So apart from the electronic information, people also are given their own hard copy and they're asked to bring it along with them when they come to our clinic. So next slide. So after people have arrived in Australia, this is a list of the investigations that we do for people to ensure that they're going to be well. So we do a variety of blood tests as well as urine tests to screen people for common illnesses. We also do a blood test for vitamin D deficiency, and that's because many of the folk who arrive in Australia and who are refugees come from Islamic backgrounds where people are covered up, so therefore their vitamin D level is likely to be lower, and plus they've been malnourished. So they've got a couple of reasons to be vitamin D deficient, and we've found vitamin D deficiency is a reasonably common problem in people who've arrived from Africa. They're also offered catch-up vaccinations to ensure that they're going to remain well, and in particular hepatitis B, if they either haven't had Hep B before or aren't carriers of hepatitis B. So it's pretty extensive what we do for people. Next slide. So that's a rundown of what we do for people in a generic, general sense. Now I'm going to talk about malaria and then schistosomiasis. But before I go on, is there any does anybody want to ask any questions about what I've said so far?
I've actually put the phones onto mute, but I can take them off mute.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, that's all right, Jane. I'll ask them.
Yeah, if you continue to the end, and then we'll see if there's any questions then. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, this is about malaria, for seeing a number of the people in this family had malaria, had active malaria, even though they were relatively well. This is a picture of an anopheline mosquito, which is the vector of malaria. So malaria is an incredibly important disease worldwide. It has significance particularly in the developing world, in the tropics, as well as for the developed world, where it's not a problem, but is a problem because we get people who are refugees as well as travellers who come back with malaria. And it's also a potential problem because of importation, and it's possible for malaria to potentially re-establish itself in some parts of the world where it's been eradicated. However, about a third of the world's population is at risk of malaria because of where they live. Annually, there's 300 to 500 million of cases a year, and the mortality is significant. Somewhere between 2 and 3 million people lose their lives every year. Generally speaking, it's Africans, and in particular, it's children who lose their lives from this disease. And falciparum is far and above the main killer. It's uncommon for the other species to kill people. Also importantly, about 30,000 travellers worldwide get infected. So this is people who come from the developed world who get infected with malaria. Now, a lot of these people don't seek treatment because they've had therapy, they've been provided with therapy that they travel with them, and then just treat themselves on spec. Also, in the States figures, I think it's about the last 10 years, there's been over 700 deaths from malaria. So these are people from the States who end up back in the States who have succumbed to malaria, and it's usually falciparum. So it's a significant problem. There's also an issue with rising drug resistance. The next slide, epidemiology of malaria. The areas on the planet with the greatest intensity of transmission, sub-Saharan Africa falls at the top of the list, followed by Oceania. So places like Papua New Guinea, for instance. That's followed by India. Now, the incidence is highest in the rainy season, but I must say that when you've got lots of flooding, the risk of getting malaria actually drops when there's been a heavy downpour. That's because, you know, the eggs and mosquitoes get washed away. But essentially, the incidence is highest when there's more water around. Next slide. There are four species. Falciparum is the biggest problem. Vivax is as a breakdown, Vivax is the commonest, and it occurs in 60% of people. Falciparum is 10 to 20%, followed by Ovale and malaria, which is the least common. Next slide. So the signs and the symptoms. So although the family didn't really have any signs, one of the kitties had an enlarged spleen, and it's likely that this family didn't have signs or symptoms, or not many signs or symptoms at least, because they all had partial immunity because of previous exposure to malaria. However, partial immunity is only ever that, and it wanes within a number of months if people don't get re-exposure to malaria. But typically people have aphthira, a fever, and the fever can have a periodicity about it. For falciparum, it can have either a periodicity of 48 hours or it can have no periodicity at all. So people get either daily fever or every second daily fever. For Vivax and Ovale, people tend to get fevers every 48 hours. And for malariae, they tend to get fevers every 72 hours. Excuse me again. Along with fever, lots of people get rigors, get shakes as well. And then beyond that, a lot of the symptoms don't actually point to any one specific organ system. So people can get gastrointestinal symptoms. For instance, they can get respiratory symptoms like cough and phlegm. Typically, they have myalgias, and on blood tests, they're anemic, they can be jaundiced, they can have a low platelet count, and often they have an enlarged liver and an enlarged spleen. The family, when they were screened, they had normal blood counts, which, as I said before, is a little unusual, which I think just points to the fact that they had partial immunity, so don't get as sick as everybody else. Next slide. To establish the diagnosis of malaria, the best test still is a blood smear, and we do what's called a thick and a thin film. The thick film helps to identify the presence of the malaria parasite. The thin film then goes on to identify the species. So then you know what to treat a person with. The blood smear remains the gold standard. There are antigen detection tests, of which we did antigen detection tests. They have great utility. They're not as good as a blood smear, but are used in conjunction with a blood smear. And the antigen detection tests can detect all of the different species of malaria, or it can detect limited number of species, depending upon the detection test. But they're great because they're both simple and they're easy to do. And the third method of diagnosis is PCR. Now, PCR is confined to only a handful of laboratories, and this is generally not done at the moment as part of the diagnosis. It's more used for as a research tool. So the next slide just shows you a blood film. Now, this is what you'd see looking at red cells. So all of these cells that you can see are all red cells. You'll see that they're paler in the middle. That's typical of a red cell because red cells are dumbbell-shaped. When you look at them in cross-section, they're dumbbell-shaped. So the paler center represents where it's thinnest. Excuse me again. The cells that have pigment in them are the ones that are parasitized. So next slide. Now, this is the life cycle of Plasmodia. So this is a complex diagram, but I just wanted to... break it down to make it simple, but essentially there are a number of key parts of the life cycle. First of all, there's the life cycle after a person has been bitten by an Anopheles mosquito. The parasite, which is in this Anopheles saliva, then gets into the bloodstream, and then the first part of the cycle actually involves the human liver. So the organisms, the parasites, enter the liver and invade liver cells. And then they divide. Once they're in the liver cells, they divide and then become what are called schisons. So some of this is a bit technical, but essentially it's just it involves the liver. The cell and the liver cells then rupture, and the new parasites get into the bloodstream, circulate in the bloodstream, then invade red cells, and then have another part of their life cycle within the red cell, and then the red cells then rupture too to release more organisms. And as part of the differentiation of the parasite, they can form what are called gametocytes, and gametocytes are the sexual forms, and they circulate in the blood. And then, for this disease to remain active and for it to get into another person, another anopheline mosquito has to come along and bite the infected person and suck up blood that contains the sexual forms, the male and the female gametocytes. And then those gametocytes then are ingested by the anopheline mosquito, then finish their own life cycle within the gut of the anopheline mosquito. And when they've matured into what are called sporozoites, they get back into the salivary gland of the mosquito to then reinfect other people. So just to summarize that, there's the life cycle in the human, which involves the liver phase and then the red cell phase, and then there's a separate life cycle within the anopheline mosquito itself. So it's very complex. So that's all I want to say about that slide. Then if you move to the next slide, this is an electron microscopy slide of red cells once again, and you can see in the middle there's a red cell that has ruptured. This red cell now is releasing daughter parasites, which are called merozoites. They're being released into the bloodstream that will then go and infect other red cells. So isn't that clever? So next slide. So I've just said about transmission. It's by the anopheline mosquito. It's a female anopheline which bites generally between dawn and dusk. And there are different ways you can get it, apart from being bitten by an anopheline mosquito. Malaria can be transmitted congenitally via blood transfusions and also sharing contaminated needles. And importantly, it can be imported as well. Next slide, falciparum. The case fatality for imported falciparum is low, and that's because we have good ways of identifying and treating it and supporting people if they're very sick. But that's not the story in the developing world. The mortality rate is much higher than that. Next slide. This is a list of complications of falciparum being the severe form. So falciparum causes hemolysis, so people become profoundly anemic. It causes kidney failure. A combination of hemolysis and kidney failure is black water fever, and that's because hemoglobin that's released from lysed red cells gets into the urine and makes the urine a dark colour. That's why it's called black water fever, and also causes kidney failure. So that's bad. And then, of course, it can affect other organs, such as the central nervous system. It can cause pulmonary edema. There are several mechanisms why people become hypoglycemic, including some of the drugs that we give to people can make people hypoglycemic. And you can get splenic rupture either acutely or in a delayed phase, which likewise will make you very sick as well. Next slide. Now, this is just a list of the current anti-malarials, and there are others that are available. Some of these can be used. Some of these drugs can only be used for certain organisms because of resistance patterns. Some of these drugs are not safe in pregnancy. But if you go to the third list, the artemisinin derivatives, they're the most recent antimalarials that have been developed. And artesunate or artemisinin is the drug of choice now for somebody who's got severe falciparum malaria. It can be given intravenously. So that's all I wanted to say about antimalarials. Next slide, public health. So the anopheline mosquito, even though malaria has been eradicated from Australia in the early 80s, the anopheline mosquito is alive and kicking up in northern Australia, and it's also present in the States. This has other significant health implications for immigrants, because when immigrants, refugees for instance, come to Australia or come to another place where there is no malaria, with time they'll lose their immunity. So when they return to their own home country, they need to be advised to have prophylaxis to protect them. And about 70% of refugees that come to Australia are from endemic regions of the world. So it's an illness that we have to think about whenever we see somebody who's a refugee here. And the other significant health issue is that malarial resistance is increasing. Okay, so that's all I want to say about malaria. Then next slide, I'm moving on to schistosomiasis now. So this slide presents a picture of actually two worms. The worm that's at the bottom is the male worm, and the worm that's lying on the top is the female worm. And the female worm is actually lying in a groove that the male worm has as part of his body for sexual reproduction. So the significance, next slide, significance of schistosomiasis, which is also called bilharzia, and that's after the man who first recognized this parasite in the mid-1800s. There are about 200 million cases worldwide. It's a very common tropical disease, and so we have to think about it every time we see somebody who's from a tropical place or somebody who's traveled to a tropical place if they're crook. It's endemic in a lot of the tropics, and it was introduced into South America, and I'll show you on a map in a minute, by African slaves. Many people have no symptoms. So that's another reason we have to think carefully about whether somebody's actually harbouring schistosomiasis. And it's a significant killer. Kills about 200,000 people. And that's a best guess, you know. Lots of people, we just don't know how they die in the developing world. So it's a best guess. There are a number of species. And there are more species. This is next slide. There are a number of species of schistosoma. The one at the bottom, Haematobium, is the one that affects primarily the kidneys and the bladder, and the others that are listed affect the gut and the liver. Next slide. As I've already outlined on the first slide, the male and the female worms grow to about 2 centimetres in length. The male has a groove where the female lies. The egg production in females varies depending upon the species. It can be up to 3,000 eggs a day. So it has a fantastic replicative ability. The lifespan in humans is 5 to 10 years. Excuse me again. And apart from reproductive tract, it also has a digestive tract of its own, and has a couple of suckers where it is able to cling to the gastrointestinal system, for instance. Next slide. So this slide outlines the life cycle. Once again, it's a fairly complicated cycle. Thankfully, not as complicated as the last one I showed you. But just to break this thing down, if you look on the right-hand side where the eggs are, the eggs are shed by the female, and if the schistosoma is within the human, when the eggs get produced, they get excreted in either human feces or the urine, depending upon the species. The eggs get into fresh water and hatch, and then when in fresh water, they have a life cycle of their own. So the eggs form what are called miracidia. The miracidia are free living ciliated organisms that cilia help to propel the organism in water, so it is able to swim and move by itself. This particular miracidia gets into a snail host, and then it divides and replicates within the snail host, and then exits the snail and gets back into fresh water again, where it originally was, and then if it comes into contact with human skin, penetrates human skin. And when it does that, it causes a rash. It causes itchiness and a pruritic rash. And the rash can be the localized at the site where the organism's penetrated, or can become generalized. And so once it's gotten into the, once it's penetrated the skin, it then migrates via the bloodstream to the liver and the lungs, as well as via lymphatic channels, and then develops into adult worms. And it develops, depending upon the species, will either develop in the bladder system, or it'll develop in the portal system. So the portal system is part of the bloodstream that services the liver. And then at that point, if it's not eradicated, you develop chronic disease, generally either in the bladder, kidneys, or in the liver. So next slide. This is just a slide of how we identify schistosomiasis. So it's all done on the basis of their eggs, and the eggs have a lateral spine, have a spine. So the first picture on the left-hand side, you can see at the bottom of this egg, there's a really prominent lateral spine. So it's the spines that actually help us to know what the egg is, and therefore what the species is. And you can see in the middle, there's a terminal spine on the left-hand side. There's a tiny spine. And then on the right-hand side for Japonicum, there's a small lateral spine, and that's hard to see. It's like actually largely obliterated. So it's the spines that help you to know what species you're dealing with, and you can see those under a microscope. Next slide. So the epidemiology, the organisms are widespread throughout Africa, the Middle East, Asia, as well as South America now because of importation. Next slide. This is the distribution now. And this just summarizes in graphic form where these species are. So schistosomiasis that is mainly hepatic and intestinal is the blue area. So it occupies a lot of Asia, as well as Brazil and countries north of Brazil and South America. Urinary schistosomiasis, and urinary schistosomiasis is due to haematobium, that occupies the Middle East and North Africa. But both types can be found throughout almost all of Africa. So just moving on to the next slide now. So factors that affect endemicity. So it's endemic in all of the tropics, essentially. So you need to have the snail intermediate host. There are only a handful of snails that will actually serve as the host. Not all snails will serve as the host. And they've got to be freshwater snails. And there are a number of different species of snail. And I won't tell you the names because it's, you know, they're long-winded names. And also poor disposal of human feces is another factor that plays into this equation. Interestingly, there are seasonal changes and fluctuations in the snail infection rates. Usually when people get schistosomiasis, they usually acquire in childhood, and I guess that's because kids spend more time splashing around in water. Then there's, if you follow people, if you follow a population serologically, it climbs into the teen years, and then when people reach the adult life, the incidence plateaus out. There's a higher transmission in rural areas, presumably because there's more water around in rural areas and people in the rural areas spend more time, such as planting rice, for instance, in fresh water. Next slide. This is just to outline the symptoms people get with schistosomiasis. So people acutely get a pruritic rash, like I was talking about. They also get, when it when the organism sheds eggs, people get what is called cationa fever, and this can be really nonspecific and it can mimic many other illnesses. This is why blood tests are so important to try and differentiate this cause of fever from lots of other causes of fever. But people get fever or chills, they get nonspecific symptoms such as headaches and myalgias and arthralgias. They also get patchy infiltrates in their lungs, so they get respiratory symptoms as well. And they commonly get enlarged livers and spleens, particularly in hepatic disease. And it can be difficult to make the diagnosis. Next slide. If the disease is not treated early, it can become chronic. And many people with chronic disease are asymptomatic. So gastrointestinal disease, essentially the worst manifestation of chronic gastrointestinal disease is chronic liver disease. And this is due to all types of schistosoma, except hematobium is the least likely to do this. You can also get intestinal polyps, which either bleed and make people anemic, or can then become cancerous later on. The other chronic form of disease is, this is the next slide, is genitourinary disease. This is due to primarily hematobium. And people get infection and inflammation of the bladder and ureters, which then fibrose and cause ureteric obstruction, which then can cause kidney failure. Alternately, people can get glomerulonephritis due to these organisms as well and develop kidney failure from a different mechanism. Having chronic infection in the bladder predisposes to bladder cancer as well. So it's a really severe problem if you have chronic infection. Next slide. Other syndromes that people can develop too chronically are pulmonary hypertension, that's rare, and you can get central nervous system involvement too. Next slide. So the way to establish a diagnosis is essentially to take a story and in particular pay attention to freshwater contact in endemic areas. We rely upon looking at the serology, so schistosomal antibody being the IgG antibody, and if that's positive, we then look for eggs in the feces or the urine. And if that doesn't help us, sometimes we elect to biopsy either the gastrointestinal system looking for eggs or biopsy polyps, which might have eggs in them. Next slide. The standard treatment for this disease is praziquantel, and we give either two or three doses. This drug is safe in pregnancy. We try to avoid giving it the first trimester of pregnancy if possible, just because of paranoia about drugs in the first trimester of pregnancy, but it's regarded as being safe in pregnancy. Next slide. From a public health perspective, the issues are that of refugees and returned travellers who might have acquired this illness once when they've been overseas. Thankfully, the intermediate snail host is not in Australia or New Zealand. So technically, we can't, in Australia and New Zealand, we can't get schistosomiasis established here. However, there's always the potential for introduction either because of migratory birds or even imported fish or plants that have been infected with the snail host. So, you know, hopefully that won't happen, but it's always going to be a possibility here. The other public health issue is that of in the developing world, some places will give mass treatment. Some people will get mass treatment with praziquantel to lessen the worm load, and that has problems with the establishment of resistance.
Great, thanks very much, Mark. I think you did fantastically well considering you're suffering really badly with laryngitis. So,
thanks.
Well done. And your timing's immaculate. What are your thoughts about the extensively resistant TB that we might be seeing more of in developing countries now?
I have lots of thoughts about that. Is there a specific thing you wanted to ask me, Jane, about that?
I mean, is Australia particularly concerned about accepting refugees in light of the test for TB pre-admission?
Yeah, it always is. And if people are found to be infected, have active TB before they are before they're sent to their new host country, treatment is initiated before they're sent here. I guess, you know, that should never be a reason why people can't be sent, because these people are usually desperate. And I must add that refugees don't want to, if they don't have to, they don't want to exit their country of birth, their homeland, where their family is, where their culture is, many refugees don't have a choice. So this should never be a barrier, in my view, to accepting refugees just because they've got an illness that might be difficult to treat. After all, the places that people generally go to are all well off and have great health systems. Does that answer your question?
I think it does, yes. Thank you. I mean, I think you've got a real passion for this area, which is fascinating insight I think you've given us today. I do hope you've enjoyed today's session and will be able to join us for more Weber Training Teleclass lectures in the future. But until then, thank you for listening in with us. Thank you again, Mark, very much for your contribution.
Okay, pleasure, Jo.
Goodbye for now. Thanks.